Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Summit, New Jersey, for a State of the Science Summit on lung cancer. At the meeting, faculty from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center shed light on early-stage interventions in lung cancer, the use of upfront next-generation sequencing, and predictive and prognostic biomarkers that are enhancing treatment decisions in non-small cell lung cancer. Faculty also spotlighted the therapeutic additions that have enhanced treatment in ALK and ROS1-positive disease, as well as ongoing research efforts dedicated to targeting rare mutations in lung cancer. Faculty also spoke to the potential use of immunotherapy as neoadjuvant therapy in earlier non-small cell lung cancer settings, and highlighted the transformative effects of this approach in select patients with advanced non-small cell and small cell lung cancer. First, we sat down with the co-chair of the meeting, Azadeh Namakaidus, MD, FACP, who is a thoracic oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Namakaidus told us that one of the more recent advances in the treatment of lung cancer includes the use of next-generation sequencing upon diagnosis, which has provided guidance on determining the optimal treatment for each individual patient. Listen on to hear Namakaidus discuss recent developments made in the treatment of patients with lung cancer and what the future holds.
We've made tremendous progress, even in the past 10 years, never mind the past 30 years. Certainly there are traditional chemotherapy regimens that are still in use and that are effective, but one of the most exciting and frankly life-changing developments in lung cancer has been the emergence of immunotherapy as an integral part of the treatment plans that we offer patients. In addition to that, there are many targeted therapies that now we are able to offer to our patients, and that's because we have been able to do next-gen sequencing and molecular analysis of tumors so that we can offer more targeted and more effective treatments to patients. The treatments are going to become more and more individualized. Even in terms of checkpoint inhibitors, we're trying to identify who are the patients who will have these long-term durable responses that we see in a small subset of the population. How do we deal with the side effects and some of the toxicities that we're seeing? As we're using these drugs more and more, we're learning more about their toxicities and adverse events and how to treat and manage them. Another question that I personally deal with in my practice and we talk about often is there a time that it's safe to stop checkpoint inhibitors after a patient has had a very good durable response, sometimes for a number of years? There are a lot of data that are emerging, and there are a lot of retrospective studies that different groups are doing to take a look at that question. It's not one that has been answered definitively yet.
Next, we spoke with Isabel Prishagul, DO, MBS, who told us that prognostic biomarkers have revolutionized treatment decisions for patients with non-small cell lung cancer, and researchers are now seeking to further enhance this precision medicine process. In our interview, Prishagul, a thoracic medical oncologist and assistant attending at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, discussed encouraging updates with molecular drivers in non-small cell lung cancer and shared her advice to community oncologists treating patients with this disease.
Over the past 10 years, I think that lung cancer has really sort of developed into a tailoring to your tumor sort of subset of oncology, where we are now looking at molecular drivers, we are looking at PD-L1, we are looking at next generation sequencing to guide our therapeutic modalities for patients, as opposed to one size fits all. Certain markers have prognostic value, certain markers have predictive value. And I think that is a very in-depth topic, but it can be very difficult to delineate once we have those, once we have those markers identified. I think we're always finding more markers, and we're refining and refining our field. So a marker that may be very predictive now, we may find does not hold much predictive value years from now. And I think that's what we're learning as we develop. Oh, I think we have our tried and true targets that we've known for many years now, EGFR, ALK, some of the newer targets on the block, ROS1, MET, exon 14, MET amplification, and now recently NTRK. I think there's been a lot of headway about that and a lot of excitement with entrectinib and also LOXO-292. There's been a lot of new and exciting approvals that have been discussed at most recent conferences, and many new ones in the pipeline that I can't wait to see what transpires. Really making sure that you have the right histologic diagnosis is so key because, as we know, histology really guides what treatments we offer. And that is the first battle, because if you're starting off on the wrong foot with the wrong diagnosis or the wrong histologic subtype, then you may be exposing your patient to therapies that may not be effective, toxicities that are unnecessary, and then unfortunate, you know, disease progression when perhaps they could have been enjoying response or stable disease.
When Daniela Molina, MD, stopped by, she shared that screening high-risk patients for lung cancer with low-dose computed tomography, along with the adoption of minimally invasive surgical approaches, have reduced lung cancer mortality. She added that outcomes could be improved even further by increasing awareness for screening and addressing the stigma that surrounds the disease. Listen on to hear Molina, director of the esophageal surgery program at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, discuss the role of screening and the implementation of minimally invasive surgical techniques in early stage lung cancer.
Lung cancer is one of the most malignant cancers that you can imagine. Mortality of lung cancer is basically higher than breast and colon and prostate together. So we have really a lot to do to improve prognosis of this kind of cancer. And finally, we have a tool to screen these patients, which is a low-dose CT scan. A very large national trial shown that when you do low-dose CT scan on high-risk patients, you can save their life 20% of the time. So that's a very important issue, because lung cancer, I have to say, is a disease that have suffered a little bit from some stigma in the past. Often we think about lung cancer, we think about smoker, we think about a disease that is caused by patients' behavior. And so there's been very little money invested in trying to prevent and screening lung cancer. Screening, I think, it's very important. We're not advertising it enough. We don't see enough patients. There's so many patients at risk of lung cancer that we could identify at an early stage and save their life, and we're not doing it. In small steps, at least we have a tool. So we can identify cancer a lot earlier. Now, because we have a tool to identify lung cancer at an early stage, we see a lot more early stage lung cancers. So small nodules that we can treat surgically. So I basically highlighted what we have to offer in terms of surgical treatment of lung cancer. And I think that we've done incredible progresses over the last several years. The most important change was the introduction of minimally invasive surgery. So we really went from big painful incision, you know, cutting of the ribs, spreading of the ribs, difficult for patient to get through it, to a much easier approach for patients to recover from. So really morbidity has been decreased, length of stays has been much improved, and patient satisfaction because the pain is much less.
Afterward, Jamie E. Chaft, MD, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, came by to discuss the Phase 3 PACIFIC trial, which showed an improvement in progression-free survival with durvalumab after concurrent chemoradiotherapy in patients with stage 3 unresectable non-small cell lung cancer. Moreover, CHAFT highlighted the preliminary signals of activity that have been reported with checkpoint inhibitors in the neoadjuvant setting, thus alluding to the tremendous potential for immunotherapy in earlier non-small cell lung cancer stages. In advanced non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, CHAFT said that the use of immunotherapy, either as monotherapy or in combination with chemotherapy, continues to raise the bar with regard to overall survival benefit in patients with newly diagnosed disease. Listen on to hear CHAFT explain how data from the PACIFIC trial have impacted the treatment of patients with stage 3 unresectable non-small cell lung cancer, share the research being done to move immunotherapy into the neoadjuvant setting, and shed light on the integration of immunotherapy into the advanced stage treatment armamentarium.
The data presented from PACIFIC in the last year was mostly that presented at ASCO, which is just really reaffirming that the overall survival data continues to trend as one would have hoped. And it truly looks like some patients are being cured by the intervention. Of course, we'd always like to see longer-term follow-up, but in this very real-world patient population, durvalumab after concurrent chemo immunotherapy is improving progression-free and overall survival and really is a standard of care in all patients, particularly patients with PD-L1 expression. The New England Journal paper is ours with Hopkins, where a small subset of patients received just 2 doses of nivolumab and had a very unexpected response rate. I think that was replicated by MD Anderson, where Tina Cascone and colleagues saw a major pathologic regression rate, very impressive with nivolumab, even more so with Nivo-Ipi, particularly in terms of the number of complete pathologic responses. The atezolizumab data doesn't look as overwhelming, but that's what happens when you have more patients. It's probably more real world and more along the lines of what we would expect, where the major pathologic regression rate or response rate appears comparable to chemo. Again, getting down to we need better biomarkers in this patient population. I think the point I made in my talk is the way of the future in this patient population is combination chemotherapy and immunotherapy, as demonstrated by Xu et al. At Columbia and now Mario Provencio and the group from Spain, where we're seeing truly amazing complete pathologic regression rates from the combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy in the preoperative setting.
Not only has osimertinib become the frontline standard of care for patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, but it is a potent and tolerable agent to examine in combination as a way to prevent acquired resistance, said Mark G. Chris, MD, a medical oncologist and William and Joy Ruan Chair in Thoracic Oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. In our interview, Chris shed light on the impact of targeted therapy in patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer and the encouraging activity that has been reported with checkpoint inhibitors in advanced squamous disease.
Almost 15 years ago, we discovered that there were a number of patients with lung cancers whose cancers were driven by mutations in the EGFR gene. And that demonstration really changed the face of lung cancer in general and adenocarcinoma in particular. What we found is by identifying the mutations, we found patients that had tumors that would always shrink when given drugs targeting the EGFR tyrosine kinase, and it opened up a new opportunity for those patients and led the way for the development of other targeted therapies. We had already seen that osimertinib improved survival of people with EGFR mutations that received it as initial therapy. So we expected that those numbers would be consistent and would continue with continued follow-up, and indeed that's what the recent presentation said. So there was a clear improvement of approximately 7 months between the standard therapies and those patients that got osimertinib as the initial treatment. Osimertinib, first and foremost, is more potent than other TKIs. It has activity against tumors that have developed a T790M mutation. It also, because of that potency, it is more effective in preventing CNS metastases. And despite the increase in potency and its greater effectiveness, it actually is more tolerable. That's becoming increasingly important, as I think we've discovered that giving a TKI is not enough for our patients with EGFR mutant lung cancers. We have to add other modalities to the TKI. And osimertinib, because of its better tolerability, opens that door. So it's more effective, prevents CNS metastases better than other TKIs, and because of its ease of use, we can add more drugs to it.
Next, we sat down with Gregory J. Riley, MD, PhD, who told us that additional ALK inhibitors have come to the forefront since the 2011 FDA approval of crizotinib for patients with ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer. In our interview, Riley, a medical oncologist and vice chair of clinical research in the Department of Medicine at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, discussed the current treatment landscapes of ALK and ROS1-positive non-small cell lung cancer.
ALK gene rearrangements happen in about 4% of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. We see these ALK gene rearrangements in a broad range of patients. We might see them somewhat more frequently in people who never smoked, sometimes in younger men, but we should test for ALK gene rearrangements throughout our population of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. We test for that because we have new drugs that are targeted at ALK gene rearrangements. There are three drugs currently FDA approved for the initial treatment of ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer. We began understanding the targeting of ALK back in 2011 with the drug crizotinib, and multiple new drugs have been developed in comparison to crizotinib and demonstrated to be superior to crizotinib for initial therapy. Today we have a number of FDA-approved drugs. These include ceritinib, alectinib, brigatinib, and crizotinib. ROS1 gene rearrangements were actually identified around the same time as ALK gene rearrangements, way back in 2007. They were identified actually in the first paper that described ALK as an overexpressed tyrosine kinase. We also saw the data showing that ROS1 was active in patients with lung cancer. Fast forward a few years after the FDA approval of crizotinib for ALK-positive lung cancer, other drugs have also been explored in this context, and I would say that ceritinib has a relatively similar efficacy, and we've also seen subsequent data that demonstrate the efficacy of crizotinib in ROS1-positive lung cancer. Entrectinib was FDA approved for the treatment of both NTRK-positive lung cancer and ROS1-positive lung cancer. We don't have head-to-head data to compare entrectinib to crizotinib, but I think it's certainly another new option. There may be a hint that entrectinib has better CNS activity, but that hasn't been demonstrated prospectively in trials.
When we spoke with Michael Offen, MD, he explained that as the use of next-generation sequencing in lung cancer increases, ongoing research is focusing on the development of new therapeutics to target less common mutations. Listen on to hear Offen, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, discuss ongoing research efforts focusing on some of these rare, targetable mutations in non-small cell lung cancer.
There are many clinical trials in these rare oncogene spaces. Knowing the right genetic platform is very important. So when you see a young patient, never smoker, and their DNA sequencing comes back negative on tissue, you may want to consider supplementing that testing with RNA sequencing or liquid biopsy. As we begin to kind of understand these rarer mutations and find actionable options for them, I think the sequencing of the sequencing is going to become more important. So for BRAF mutant lung cancer, specifically for BRAF V600, the current standard of care is a combination of a RAF and MEK inhibitor, dabrafenib and trametinib. It has a reasonable response rate, however, there are notable toxicities. So there are current clinical trials of other RAF-MEK combinations trying to evaluate for better toxicity profiles, but at present, dabrafenib and trametinib would be the standard. In the RET space right now, there are NCCN guideline recommendations, but I would dare say that they're relatively toxic, lower response rates than we would hope for. But I think with LOXO as well as BLU-667, which is also in the space, there is hope for a better targetable option here. I would say both medications are well tolerated. LOXO had a bit of a signal for a slightly better overall response rate, but it's unfair to really say that in a cross-trial comparison. But overall, I think everyone's very excited, hoping for the breakthrough designation to lead to approval shortly to give patients better options. For NTRK, obviously that was kind of big news over the last 12 months. So there's larotrectinib and entrectinib in that space now. Larotrectinib in and of itself was a landmark approval because it was both age and histology agnostic, which is the first time that's occurred. While NTRK is exquisitely rare in less than 1% of tumors, and less approximately 0.2% of lung cancers based on the most recent data, in those patients that have NTRK fusion-driven tumors, response rates are robust, toxicity profiles are quite reasonable, mostly grade 1, grade 2, PFS is measured in year plus. So I do think these medications are and have changed the way we treat those rare tumors harboring NTRK fusions. In the HER2 setting, there are medications that are in the guidelines and under further investigation. There is activity with afatinib as well as TDM1, the ADC in the HER2 space, did show activity that was published by Bob Lee and his colleagues recently. Other medications, including novel ADCs such as medications by Daiichi, are under investigation now. I would definitely say in the HER2 space, it's a growing field with burgeoning new options.
We closed out the night with W. Victoria Lay, MD, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Lay shared that the addition of immunotherapy to standard chemotherapy has resulted in an overall survival advantage in patients with newly diagnosed extensive stage small cell lung cancer, shifting not only the frontline standard, but potentially second line treatment as well. Listen on to hear Lay discuss the impact immunotherapy has had on the management of patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer.
Small cell lung cancer is, relative to non-small cell lung cancer, we know that it actually has a lot more mutations in the tumor itself. It has a higher, on average, has a much higher tumor mutation burden. And based on what we understand about the available biomarkers in non-small cell lung cancer, including PD-L1 and tumor mutation burden, we would have thought that immunotherapy might have worked even more effectively in small cell lung cancer, but we found out that that's not really the case. In fact, it's maybe just a little less effective. It's definitely doesn't have the same effect as we would expect. And that goes to, I think that speaks to the fact that we still need to understand a lot more about the underlying biology of small cell lung cancer and try to find different and novel ways to combine modalities of treatment to maximize effectiveness against tumor killing. Before the addition of immunotherapy to first-line chemotherapy, consolidative chest radiation after initial chemotherapy has been a standard of care, although not necessarily practiced at every institution, but it is in the it's in our practice guidelines that if patients have a great response everywhere else in the body and they have residual thoracic disease, their overall survival is prolonged with chest radiation. Chest radiation was not allowed in both studies, and so I think one of the open questions is how do we sequence that and how do we integrate that with what we know from both of those studies. We do know that prophylactic cranial radiation was allowed and some patients did opt for that, some providers did opt for that, but I think that's still an unanswered question, and it's a question that we'll need to discuss among ourselves in the community. What's the best and optimal way to sequence these treatment modalities? With the addition of immunotherapy, we are seeing a shift in what the optimal second line treatment should be. Before the addition of immunotherapy, the chemotherapy in the first line, I think generally in the small cell lung cancer community, our preference was immunotherapy in the second line with ipi/nivo based on the CheckMate 032 data. Now that we're adding immunotherapy to first line, that really does open up the second line options more. And I think that there provides more room for other treatments from other drug groups, because the logic is that if someone progressed on anti-PD-L1 therapy, you know, we might think twice about putting them on another PD-1 inhibitor, even if you are adding a CTLA-4 inhibitor. We're in a very exciting time for small cell lung cancer drug development. It's definitely much better than it was 10 or 20 years ago, but we still have a long way to go in terms of improvement and in terms of proving overall survival and long-term outcomes for our patients. So one thing that I do want to say is that a lot of patients come to us and have the conception that, or notion that clinical trials is really for when you are at the end of your treatment course. It's when you don't have any other better options and this is the last thing left, and that's certainly not the case. As you know, IMpower 133 and Caspian were both first-line studies. There are other first-line studies that are being conducted, and new trials are always opening, particularly for small cell lung cancer when the benefits of our treatments currently
currently are not where we like them to be, I really do encourage providers and patients to consider clinical trials at every line of their treatment.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live on Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science Summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science Summits for those interested in attending. If you would like to learn about the latest treatment advances in ovarian cancer, consider registering for the April 23rd State of the Science Summit in Cincinnati, Ohio. We will also be holding a State of the Science Summit on Precision Medicine on May 7th in Detroit, Michigan. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.